I would hate to tell you what this lousy little book cost me in money and anxiety and time. When I got home from the Second World War 23 years ago, I thought it would be easy for me to write about the destruction of Dresden, since all I would have to do would be to report what I had seen. And I thought, too, that it would be a masterpiece, or at least make me a lot of money, since the subject was so big. But not many words about Dresden came from my mind then, not enough of them to make a book anyway, and not many words come now, either, when I've become an old fart with his memories and his Pall Malls, with his sons and daughters full grown. I think of how useless the Dresden part of my memory has been, and yet how tempting Dresden has been to write about, and I am reminded of the famous limerick. There was a young man from Stamboul who soliloquized thus to his tool. You took all my wealth and you ruined my health, and now you won't pee, you old fool. And I'm reminded, too, of the song that goes, my name is Jan Janssen, I work in Wisconsin, I work in a lumber mill there. The people I meet when I walk down the street, they say, what's your name? And I say, my name is Jan Janssen, I work in Wisconsin, and so on, to infinity. Over the years, people I've met have often asked me what I'm working on. I've usually replied that the main thing was a book about Dresden. And I said that to Harrison Starr, the movie maker, one time, and he raised his eyebrows and inquired, is it an anti-war book? Yes, I said, I guess. You know what I say to people when I hear they're writing anti-war books? No, what do you say, Harrison Starr? I say, why don't you write an anti-glacier book instead? What he meant, of course, was that there would always be wars and that they were as easy to stop as glaciers. I believe that, too. And even if wars didn't keep coming like glaciers, there would still be plain old death. When I was somewhat younger, working on my famous Dresden book, I asked an old war buddy named Bernard V. O'Hare if I could come to see him. He was a district attorney in Pennsylvania. I was a writer on Cape Cod. We had been privates in the war, infantry scouts. We had never expected to make any money after the war, but we were doing quite well. I had the Bell Telephone Company find him for me. They are wonderful that way. I have this disease late at night sometimes, involving alcohol and the telephone. I get drunk and I drive my wife away with a breath like mustard gas and roses. And then, speaking gravely and elegantly into the telephone, I ask the telephone operators to connect me with this friend or that one, from whom I have not heard in years. I got O'Hare on the line this way. He is short and I am tall. We were Mutt and Jeff in the war. We were captured together in the war. I told him who I was on the telephone. He had no trouble believing it. He was up. He was reading. Everybody else in his house was asleep. Listen, I said, I'm writing this book about Dresden. I'd like some help remembering stuff. I wonder if I could come down and see you and we could drink and talk and remember. He was unenthusiastic. He said he couldn't remember much. He told me, though, to come ahead. I think the climax of the book will be the execution of poor old Edgar Derby, I said. The irony is so great. A whole city gets burned down and thousands of people are killed. And then this one American foot soldier is arrested in the ruins for taking a teapot. And he's given a regular trial and then he's shot by a firing squad. Uh-huh, said O'Hare. Don't you think that's really where the climax should come, I said. I don't know anything about it, he said. That's your trade, not mine. I think about my education sometimes. I went to the University of Chicago for a while after the Second World War. I was a student in the Department of Anthropology. At that time, they were teaching that there was absolutely no difference between anybody. They may be teaching that still. Another thing they taught us was that nobody was ridiculous or bad or disgusting. Shortly before my father died, he said to me, you know, you never wrote a story with a villain in it. I told him that was one of the things I learned in college after the war. Even then, I was supposedly writing a book about Dresden. It wasn't a famous air raid back then, in America anyway. Not many Americans knew how much worse it had been than Hiroshima, for instance. I didn't know that either. There hadn't been much publicity. I wrote the Air Force back then asking for details about the raid on Dresden. Who ordered it? How many planes did it? Why they did it? What desirable results there had been, and so on. I was answered by a man who, like myself, was in public relations. He said that he was sorry, but that the information was top secret still. I read the letter out loud to my wife, and I said, "Secret? My God, from whom?" We were United World Federalists back then. I don't know what we are now. Telephoners, I guess. We telephone a lot, or I do anyway, late at night. I taught creative writing in the famous Writer's Workshop at the University of Iowa for a couple of years after that. I got into some perfectly beautiful trouble, got out of it again. I taught in the afternoons. In the mornings I wrote. I was not to be disturbed. I was working on my famous book about Dresden. And somewhere in there, a nice man named Seymour Lawrence gave me a 3-book contract. And I said, "Okay, the first of the 3 will be my famous book about Dresden." The friends of Seymour Lawrence call him Sam. And I say to Sam now, "Sam, here's the book." It is so short and jumbled and jangled, Sam, because there is nothing intelligent to say about a massacre. Everybody is supposed to be dead, to never say anything or want anything ever again. Everything is supposed to be very quiet after a massacre, and it always is, except for the birds. And what do the birds say? All there is to say about a massacre. Things like pooty wheat. I have told my sons that they are not, under any circumstances, to take part in massacres, and that the news of massacres of enemies is not to fill them with satisfaction or glee. I have also told them not to work for companies which make massacre machinery and to express contempt for people who think we need machinery like that. I looked through a Gideon Bible one time for tales of great destruction. The sun was risen upon the earth when Lot entered unto Zoar, I read. Then the Lord rained upon Sodom and upon Gomorrah brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And he overthrew these cities, and all the plain, and all the inhabitants of the cities, and that which grew upon the ground. So it goes. Those were vile people in both those cities, as is well known. The world was better off without them. And Lot's wife, of course, was told not to look back where all those people and their homes had been. But she did look back, and I'd love her for that, because it was so human. So she was turned to a pillar of salt. So it goes. People aren't supposed to look back. I'm certainly not going to do it anymore. I've finished my war book now. The next one I write is going to be fun. This one is a failure, and it had to be, since it was written by a pillar of salt. It begins like this. Listen. Billy Pilgrim has come unstuck in time. It ends like this. Pooty wheat.